TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Who were the Luddites? Machine smashers of the 19th century? Or members of a fascinating social movement with visionary insights into the unfolding drama of industrialization? Ian Bull is a historian of technology, science, and medicine. He taught a course on the Luddites at Stanford University. Ian Bull's connection to the Luddites was inspired by E.P. Thompson, the great British author and leader of the European nuclear disarmament movement. When E.P. Thompson died in 1993, the most often quoted reference in the obituaries was to his love and respect for the 19th century Luddites. Thompson had wanted to, quote, recover them from the enormous condescension of posterity, end of quote. Here is part one of a two-part program on the Luddites with Ian Bull, recorded at an informal gathering of friends at TUC Radio. Ian Bull.
I guess in about 1967, I read Edward Thompson's great book, The Making of the English Working Class. It was the founding text, really, of what he came to call history from below. And it was a kind of agitational text as it was read originally. It's since moved into the academy and been domesticated in that way. At that time, certainly in the United States too, it was read as an agitational text and was carried in the factory floors and things in Detroit and elsewhere by a generation of young people, especially who and has interestingly since become the most important model of a kind of generalized historiography from below. And some of you might know E.P. Thompson. He worked for many years in adult education. His mother was American. His father was a missionary in India who lost his faith and came back and ended up teaching Bengali in Oxford. And Edward and Dorothy Thompson, who the woman he married in the mid-40s, joined the Communist Party and didn't leave it until 1956. He worked in adult education, and in those early years, he wrote his first two books. The first one, a biography of William Morris, which is very important in the history of Luddism too. I mean, Morris was one of the great figures trying to theorize resistance to the Industrial Revolution. He was the first sort of English domestic Marxist. He's been sort of whitewashed. People think of him now as the designer of chintz and wallpaper and things like that, you know, and of course, and you know, the inspirer of the arts and crafts movement and so forth, and that's all true. But he was also much more than that. And Thompson wrote a biography. He then went on to write this extraordinary book, *The Making of the English Working Class*. The central element of which was an enormously long essay in the middle of this book about the historical Luddites. And that was the moment at which I became interested in the question of Luddism. And I worked with Edward Thompson after he stormed back into public life, the finest sort of orator, the last, I think, great public orator in Britain, I would say. He came back and led the European nuclear disarmament movement. He wrote an astonishing pamphlet called "Protest and Survive" in response to a grotesque government publication called "Protect and Survive," which was how to, you know, crouch under the stairs and, you know, survive Armageddon and so on. And that, in a sense, sparked the revival of the nuclear disarmament movement. I mean, the occasion for it, by the way, of course, was the decision to accept cruise missiles in Europe, taken in December of 79. And this got Edward Thompson really riled up. And he had always been writing. There's a famous collection of his called Writing by Candlelight, which registers his magnificent polemic on behalf of radical democratic values. Against the security state, written during the 70s. So I was working with him and others in this kind of suddenly and massively burgeoning movement in about in 1980 to 82 to try to resist the new sort of nuclearization of Europe. He ended up actually in a very with a very kind of strange book at the end, which I've reviewed, on Blake. He was deeply versed in literature as well, and so part of his oratory, the greatness of his oratory, was that not only was his, did he see his project as sort of rescuing the Luddites, as he said, from the enormous condescension of posterity, which it might be taken to be the kind of project of history from below, women's history, labor history, the history of slavery. I mean, all that work which is now going on is only just sort of scratching the surface. He finished up with a book on Blake, and one of the great things about listening to him fulminate was that he would pepper his oratory with references to Bunyan and Blake and Shelley and Wordsworth, all those radicals in a kind of in a Euro tradition, which, you know, one should have in one's backpack. So I remember in one great moment in Hyde Park, where there were like 250,000 people, this was probably in about 1981, he came to the platform and he opened with a, "Against the beast we witnesses shall rise." And say what? You know, I mean, there was a young generation who had never read any Blake, you know, but for him, you know, it was absolutely crucial to understand. And he saw Blake, in a sense, as a kind of a model of resistance. After the collapse of the English Revolution in the 17th century, people essentially had to go underground. And modes of resistance were, you have to look in difficult places and strange places to find modes of resistance. The point about Luddism is that what I have been doing in my work around it is to try to, A, take the historical Luddites seriously, and I'll say something about them, and then to, as it were, try to develop a generalized, a theorization of Luddism such that we would include under the rubric Luddite, not because we wish necessarily to preserve the term Luddite, although it's very useful for reasons that I'll come to, but because we need a very broad social movement that will include social resistance, not just to the machine, but to the machine taken metaphorically, to include all those forces that are, as it were, working against life. And I'll try to elaborate those later. Thompson did very interesting work in showing that you do find resistance, you have to look for it, it's there, one mustn't romanticize it, and that's another thing I'm going to try and talk about. But he died quite depressed, I think, about because his vision of a free, socialist, peaceable Europe, which was the animus behind his work in the 80s, as a kind of public intellectual and so on. What happened, of course, in the aftermath of 89 was that it became clear that the elements of resistance are clearly there, and I mean, that goes on, but the question is, what is the utopian dimension that we wish to move towards? And that seems to me to be shown to be more or less bankrupt at the moment. That is to say, it's clear that in the case of Germany, for example, that the social imaginary has been entirely filled up by the cornucopia of capitalism. I mean, is it really shopping that we want to do? And of course, we mustn't be snooty. We mustn't be sniffy about the desire for white goods in Eastern Europe. We have to do very hard work to understand how it is that our own imaginations are deformed, and that the sort of the partiality of our resistance and so forth. Well, maybe I'll say something about the historical Luddites. In the course that I did at Stanford, which I did with Marina, the shape of it was moved from the historical moment of the Luddites through to the the generalizing of Luddism to these other contemporary sites of resistance. The historical Luddites, Thompson's project was to, as he said, to recover them from the enormous condescension of posterity, and a phrase that was used endlessly in the obituaries. Who were the Luddites? Well, of course, the context of the Luddites is very important. It was the world historical transformation, the process that liberals call industrialization. It has many moments to it, including urbanization, for example, the mills, the automation of production that began in a serious way in the 18th century, was the context in which this important moment of resistance occurred. Luddites were called Luddites because this was a social movement without leaders, although there was a mythic leader, General Ludd or Ned Ludd, who signed the messages which were given to the mill owners, the owners of the new textile mills. The Industrial Revolution was primarily, you can see it mainly through the history of textiles. What the Luddites were doing was, and people know one thing about the Luddites, is that these were people who took very large hammers, which they often called Enoch, after the Old Testament figure, very large hammers, and smashed the power looms. Now, I like Luddite because it still has power as a term, because it's still a powerful swear word of capital. To be Luddite is what? Well, of course, it is to be mindlessly against progress. It is the breaking of machinery. I mean, sort of, you know, with really no hope of success. You know, now of course we must be clear-eyed about the fact that the Luddites failed. The Luddites were mainly centered in the English Midlands, and they operated in famous insurgencies from 1811 to 1816, at which point a number of the leaders, although there really clearly were no leaders, it was in fact a very widespread social movement, a number of the so-called leaders were hanged, especially in York. And there's a marvelous speech, the only speech that Lord Byron ever gave in the House of Lords, was in defense of the Luddites. At the moment of the promulgation of the bill to make machine breaking a capital offense. It is significant that historians' standard dominant history says that the movement of history is one from superstition, pre-modernity, to scientific disenchantment of the world. I think it's very significant that 10 years before the introduction of hanging for the breaking of inanimate machinery, the death penalty for witchcraft was abolished. So that registers one disenchantment of the world, if you like. I mean, probably because, in fact, you know, witchcraft was no longer a serious threat in the sense that witchcraft had posed a threat, representing a moment of an alternative worldview to rational bourgeois utilitarian thought and the masculinization of healing and all that. But surely the imposition of the death penalty for the Luddites registers fresh enchantments. That is to say, what we're getting, of course, is the valorization of machinery over humans. And I would say that this is a kind of entry point now, if I can just say that this is the way it seems to me that we need to move towards generalizing Luddism and our various moments of resistance by arguing that the historical Luddites were breaking machines, not because they hated technology. For heaven's sake, these were skilled artisans. Good God, they designed these machines. These were artisans who were textile workers. They were skilled artisans. What they were breaking the machines for was, of course, that it was the new social relations that were implied in the factory. It's notable, for example, that when you actually look at what the Luddites were doing, they often were breaking old machines, old looms, and leaving new looms. Well, why would they do that if it was new machinery that one thinks of as sort of Luddite resistance against new technologies? Well, it all depended on how the machines were being inserted into the whole ensemble of the relations of production. That is to say, what they were against was the ganging up in batteries of power looms into factories. The factory, in fact, is nothing but the incarceration of manufacture. It is the incarceration of production. The logic of incarceration, of course, has to do with a kind of Michel, in a Foucauldian formulation, would be to do with surveillance and so on. And we can come back later to look at the way in which the new technologies of information and communication, the computer, is used for remote surveillance. I mean, it may be that, in a sense, the new technologies of information allow production again to be put out to the homes in the way that the textile industry was before it was engrossed inside a factory. It was these new factory conditions, of course, that upset, to say the least, the skilled artisans. I mean, they were faced with not just de-skilling, but, of course, with actually being thrown out of work completely. Because, of course, the new machinery was entirely able to be serviced, and more conveniently in some cases, by, for example, child labor. So there's another story of industrialism. You have the extraordinary immiseration of people, particularly women and children, in the early days of the Industrial Revolution. Often a working day of 16 hours, death at a very young age. One of the glories of the liberal reform movement in Victorian England, of course, was the abolition of the horrors of child labor and vastly long working days. Well, it may be a glory, but the fact is that if you look at the history of the enclosures worldwide, and by enclosures I mean the seizing of people's livelihoods, of the means of production off the land, and that's what urbanization actually really represents. Not that people from the country don't wish to go to the city. I think it's important not to be sort of anti-urban in some way here, because we have no option, actually. But it's very important to recognize this enormous world historical shift, which begins with Manchester, if you like, as the first industrial city. The great document by Engels, who himself, of course, was a cotton manufacturer in Manchester. He was on the spot. Engels's great public health incendiary document about the conditions of work, the conditions of living in Manchester in 1844. The horrors in the heartland here, I mean, have in a sense just been displaced. What I'm saying is that, you know, child labor is still kind of routine worldwide, so that it's very important that we recognize that our comfort is clearly at the expense of the immiseration of people worldwide. So that, therefore, what I propose in the matter of Luddism is to generalize Luddism to include not just the historical Luddites, of course, who were the, if you like, the first generation facing this world historical shift in enclosures to an urban, alienated, dehumanized life, but that it should be generalized to include all social movements of resistance to the machine. And here I'm using the machine not just, of course, in the sense of the power loom, but to the machine as Lewis Mumford, the great philosopher of technology, as he described the machine, in, if you like, in abstract terms. That's to say, he says that the first machines in the world were not actually in the metal, as one would say, or wooden. They were actually flesh and bone. They were the gangs that, say, built the pyramids, that did the huge public work projects in systems of slavery, or in, at least we can say in various degrees of unfreedom, that work, as it were, without a head. They become merely hands or backs. The military is a machine. Frederick Taylor, the great theorist of efficiency in factory production, Frederick Taylor, who wrote his Principles of Scientific Management in 1911, published it, he says very clearly, the ideal worker in the factory should be like an ox. That dehumanization is, if you like, a feature of much work under the social division of labor, under capitalism. I don't actually really want to confine it to capitalism, at least, you know, Western capitalism, because the fact is that no one was more thrilled by Frederick Taylor's efficiency than Lenin. We're talking here about capitalism and state capitalism. They're really variants of one system, if you like. And one needs here to say that when Marx theorizes machinery and modes of production, and under-theorizes, by the way, modes of destruction, it's important to recognize the way in which Marx himself, of course, was thrilled by modern technology. Now, of course, he had a view that it was going to not just sweep away superstition and spring us free, but that nevertheless it was going to be absolutely crucial that modern technologies should be there in order that we can have the cornucopia which allows us to move from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom. And if you read Marx's American Journalism, for example, his writings in the New York newspapers on, say, India, it's really quite remarkable and very salutary to see the way in which he himself reveals himself to be, in that sense, a kind of an optimistic Victorian gentleman in relation to technology. The coming of the railways to India for him was absolutely crucial in sweeping away the nightmare of feudal relations. Capitalism was a kind of awkward stage in history that we would go through and come out the other side. At the same time, of course, as Marx was theorizing the machine and so on, there were others looking at the legacy of the Luddites and in industrial life who had other views and had other ways of looking at it. I think particularly of Ruskin and Morris. Now, their utopian vision of a resistance to the nightmares of capitalist production was, in fact, a kind of retrospective utopia. It was an evocation of a golden age that had passed. They were looking back to what Marx, in a sense, was particularly horrified by, namely a kind of medieval organic community where there was solidarity and meaningful work, especially. William Morris's great inspiration was going out into the countryside, the English countryside, and seeing the churches that were built by medieval artisans. So, I mean, here's immediately a kind of an important question. Any discussion of the Luddites must presuppose some view of the role of technology generally to humanity and our flourishing. It seems that, in terms of kind of a philosophical anthropology, that we are, in some important way, constituted by our tools. there's a kind of masculinist story about this, how it all began with the hunters and things, you know, that sort of thing. And the history of technology is typically told through sort of large, pointy things which survive in stone. Whereas I think, you know, a proper history of technics would actually begin with containers and soft, curvy things like, you know, pots and textiles and things, which don't, so they're either in shards or they've rotted away and so on. So that one then would find, you know, the history of mathematics and logic being rooted in the kind of patterns that you find being practically evolving in the work of women, probably. But nevertheless, the point is that what we need, in fact, is a kind of, at this point, is a discussion of homo faber. Engels had a wonderful essay about the relation between humans standing upright, the hand and the brain. And you can know which sort of came first. Did we stand up and say, gosh, what are we going to do with these sort of thing? And then our thumbs swiveled round and we started, you know, handling things, and then our cortex developed because, gosh, you had to think of things to do with the hands. Or did you, you know, which came first? Did you stand up because you wanted to have, you know, and there's that kind of interesting dialectic about, and there was a long, big Victorian discussion, of course, in the context of theories of evolution. But nevertheless, it seems absolutely crucial here that we understand that we have very importantly to grapple with the question of technics. And that's why, you know, contemporary discussions of Luddism seem so tricky, because there's a kind of idiot response which says, gosh, you must be somehow against all machines, as if that were a possible position. So the first thing to say about the power looms was that the Luddites themselves knew fully well that they were not against all machines, for heaven's sake. Nevertheless, it may be the case that when we elaborate a kind of a theory of Luddite resistance, of social resistance, on behalf of life, as it were, if we're against somehow the forces of death and a kind of necrotic, the technologies of death and destruction.
That was Ian Bull, editor with James Brook of the anthology Resisting the Virtual Life. He taught a course on the Luddites at Stanford University. In part two of this program, Ian Bull joins the legacy of the Luddites with a critique of modern technologies such as automobiles, urban sprawl, highways, and clear cuts. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. Our website is www.tucradio.org. And I want to send a very warm welcome to the listeners of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening.